Hi, I'm Gail from Europod. Before enjoying your podcast, allow me to say a few words about Europe Talks Back. In the third season of Europe Talks Back, I want to uncover the topics that matter, or should matter, to all of us. From gender to bodies and sex, digital to migration and urban landscapes, and everything in between. Rather than focusing on macro-level policies, let's zoom in and talk to the brave activists and volunteers with lived experience, who are working directly with marginalized communities to further equity, justice, and liberation for all.
Europod. In 2019, Indonesia's President Widodo announced that the national capital will relocate from Jakarta to Borneo. Areas of the North Jakarta, including the seawall designed to protect its citizens, is falling at an estimated 25 centimeters a year. The city of Jakarta does not pipe enough drinkable water, so the citizens rely largely on wells that extract water from shallow aquifers, leading to the land above it to collapse. In the past, some civilizations have undergone a collapse, a loss of socio-political economic complexities, usually accompanied by a dramatic decline in population size. In many, if not most, cases of over-exploitation of the environment was one proximate or an ultimate cause. Welcome back to the Water Series. I'm your host, Zeynep Kosmi, data analyst and global shaper. In this episode, we will discuss the underlying factors, what a water crisis is one of the root causes of community displacement. I had a chance to interview Nidhi Nakhabatla and Cameron Fioret. Nidhi Nakhabatla is based in Belgium. She's a senior fellow and coordinator at the United Nations University Institute. She has over 21 years of work experience as a sustainability science expert. Cameron Fioret, from the University of Guelph in Canada, recently finished his doctorate research and address the moral implications of selling and exploiting the natural resource of water. His research argued that the quest for natural resources will place a strain on all people, but especially the poorest. Water has always influenced where we live. Today, shifting climate patterns accelerate the global water crisis, which increases the movement of people around the world. But how exactly is migration linked to the water crisis?
A few of the case studies that Nidhi and I have looked at in a policy brief from last year and in our recent book chapters, we look at small island developing states. So we can think about Kiribati or Micronesia in the South Pacific. Water scarcity there pertains to a lack of potable water, a lack of fresh water, but also the water extreme of flooding, of sea level rise, and of seawater, salt water, getting into the groundwater and the potable water supply. These nations in the South Pacific, for instance, but other, you know, small island developing states, such as in the Caribbean, face an existential crisis. Other states around the world face this as an issue of migration over land, but the state itself or the land still will exist. But in Micronesia or Kiribati, the sea is rising and there will no longer be a physical state there. So this is very much an existential and extreme push factor for migration.
Small islands have been disappearing. The long-term effects of climate change, such as sea level rise and unpredictable weather patterns, threaten the livelihoods of communities in the Pacific, Caribbean, and Indian Ocean islands. This increases the risks of forced migration. The UN World Water Development Report estimated that by 2050, around 200 million people could be displaced as a result of desertification, sea level rise, and increased extreme weather events.
Climate change will significantly impact freshwater availability, and it will reshape migration patterns. There's already been a serious migration pattern over the past decade or so from the Middle East and North Africa into Europe. That's an issue of political instability, but when you dig a little deeper, you can look that this is an issue of water scarcity, of food scarcity, and how that trickles down to issues that are social and economic, but are fundamentally issues of a lack of access to this resource. And going forward, if we don't limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, it will reshape migration patterns in ways that maybe we can predict for, let's say, tens of millions of people from Southeast Asia moving further inland and more towards economic centers. But it will also shape migration in ways that we can't quite concretely fathom quite yet.
More cities are facing day zero events. Due to these day zero events, migration patterns are shifting. In our current world, almost 15% of the global population is on the move. With more than 244 million international migrants and 763 million internal migrants. The management of such flows has become an international, regional, and national governance concern. The relationship between water, climate, and migration is complex and cannot be easily quantified or separated from other contributing and driving factors. Towards a more in-depth understanding of specific triggers of such interlinkages, the specific local context is absolutely necessary. Therefore, I asked Nidhi Dakhabatla to explain these patterns.
Let me give you an example of Bangladesh, where I've worked in several projects when I was working with CGIAR. And in that region, when we're working in one of the Delta Basin regions in Rajshahi province, the local stakeholders, the local farmers and the local leaders said that in the past years, their fields were inundated or they were flooded only for 1 to 2 months. But because of the change in rainfall patterns, now they can see that their fields are filled with water up to 3 to 6 months. 6 months in case of low-lying areas. So for 6 months, they don't have access to grow any crop. They don't have any income source. So some of these people who don't have any other alternative, they can go to urban areas to work as maybe a labor in the urban landscape. And then they come back in dry season when that water has receded. So this is a case of seasonal migration and return migration. And this is a much more stable case of migration. But some people who don't have access to land ownership or they don't own any resources, for them, they because of this this fluctuation in the income generation or the opportunity to be employed, they may go for a permanent migration. They would permanently maybe settle in urban spaces to work in different sectors. And some people may even decide to cross international borders for larger avenues. So from one setting, you can see different types of migrations may emerge. And understanding this requires a very local level analysis, talking to stakeholders, collecting primary data, analyzing the context. So this migration, environmental migration studies can be quite complex and intensive, but they are very important as well. The seasonal migration will increase as the impact of climate and water crisis increase. So there's a direct proportion. If you had crisis that's staying in that landscape for a longer time, you may see that the seasonal migration will also increase and there will be less return migration because the opportunities are shrinking to be employed to generate income. Similarly, with increasing events of water extremes like floods, the intensity, the gradient, and the frequency of flood events will also force people to look for other avenues of economic generation or income generation.
Predicting future flows of climate migrants is complex, Nidhi and Cameron aimed at unpacking the relationship between water and migration. To understand and assess these patterns, they use a 3D model.
So we're looking at a 3D model: water quantity, water quality, and water-related extremes. These are the three dimensions that push people to migrate due to water issues. So with water quantity, it pertains to the amount of water available, the quality of that water, and these three dimensions are tied together. So with water quantity, how much water is there, but the quality of it is it clean, fresh water? Is it potable? At the bare bones of it, is this usable water? And without sufficient quantity and quality, you'll get a push factor of people migrating. Now with water-related extremes, those are, for instance, floods, hurricanes or typhoons, but also extreme scarcity of water, so droughts. These three dimensions, alone or together or in some combination, are the main factors in driving people to migrate.
To outline how the water crisis affects migration patterns, we will look at two case studies. The first case study we discussed is the Aral Sea, in which migration is driven by the water crisis and associated adverse health consequences.
With the Aral Sea, the sea has been severely depleted, and it's caused people to migrate due to a lack of water, a lack of economic, a lack of jobs, and it's a result of inefficient agriculture and damming practices. Now, this is an issue of linking migration and water security as well. In the former Soviet Union, they were using these inefficient policies to dam and cordon off, but then control the water from the Aral Sea with these unintended consequences. Now, it's left serious ecological fallout, and there is an undeniable link there, and also with small island developing states, of individuals being pushed from where water was plentiful or, you know, efficiently used, to now not only is there the issue of migration, it's left the potential for these places to, especially with Micronesia and Kiribati, not even exist going forward. So this is a pressing and an existential issue.
Another case study is that of the Lake Chad, where water scarcity is one of the causes for regional migration. In the past decades, a significant portion of the open water surface of the Lake Chad has completely dried up. Most farmers and cattle herders have moved towards greener areas, where they compete for land resources with the host communities, and therefore potentially leading to tensions.
Billions of dollars have been allocated as funds to revive Lake Chad. But what we see also in parallel, that there is a rise in sort of extremism and violent conflicts in the region. People have been suffering due to lack of food security, water security, but also impacted by violent conflicts. The Boko Haram connection is something that also has been drawn to the water scarcity and the ongoing water crisis in the region. And the European region has been on the side of hosting some of these people who have fallen the victim of these crises and have been forced to migrate. And there is a geopolitical connection between the African region and the European region for the Lake Chad that has been widely discussed in the political forums. And specific to this discussion is the case of Transaqua, which is interbasin water transfer. So everyone agrees that Lake Chad is a big crisis. So we need to address that crisis. So Lake Chad needs to get some water so that people can practice their livelihood activities like fisheries and agriculture. And so they decided in 1970s, an Italian firm, Bonafica, decided that because of the Mediterranean security, we should help Lake Chad region to have that water revival strategy and bring water from the Congo Basin through canal, which would be 2,500 kilometers long. But the Congo Basin countries were not on board that plan. So you can't make a plan where you're bringing water from these countries are not a part of that discussion. So there were some inherent flaws in that plan, and from the 1980s, that proposal has gone through several changes. It is still a proposal. It has not manifested into a project. And we have researched a lot on that proposal and how it may have potential or may not have potential on the political and the human security of this region, Lake Chad. And specifically, it's of interest to Europe because there is an underlying assumption that if you manage the Lake Chad crisis, the flow of the migration flow from that region to Europe can be managed. Well, it may be assumptive, but maybe there is some merit in that assumption. In the case of Lake Chad, the countries and the regional authorities and even the international agencies have sort of endorsed projects that involve private sector. That is another problem in the mix. So these were traditionally state affairs on water decisions. The state decides who gets what, and in shared resources, the resource-sharing parties decide. But now we have a private actor. Like in case of Lake Chad, you have this Italian firm. Now you have Power China. Now, and there are many other international private sector players a part of this discussion. So that does not make it easy. That makes it even more complex. So when the complexity is increasing, the negotiation and the tactical approaches to settle these conflicts, to agree for consensus building, to agree to and common agenda, consensus building should be also boosted to ensure that there is a positive outcome for communities and the region.
The World Bank has recommended that governments partner with private companies to better deliver drinking and wastewater services to communities in developing areas. Such approaches have, in many places, undermined the ability of the poor to access these services. Remember episode 3 on water as a human right?
Water is a limited natural resource and a public good fundamental for life and health. The human right to water is indispensable for leading a life in human dignity. It is a prerequisite for the realization of other human rights.
Private stakeholders complicate the whole water setting. Private operations can create obstacles to the human right to affordable and accessible water and sanitation services. For example, in Guayaquil, Ecuador, water prices increased by 180% after the water system there was taken over by Interagua. Customers of the private water provider in Jakarta, Indonesia, experienced a 258% increase in tariffs and poor water quality, while only 54% of the low-income households were provided with new water connections. And then, you have the case of Bolivia.
This famous case of Cochabamba in Bolivia, where the water was privatized. So the government said, oh, it's very difficult for us to fix a price to supply water to all the population. Let's privatize it. So let's get a private sector to operate the water supply system. Then some of the American companies from US, they bid for it and they got the contract and they became the water supply system operators in Bolivia. And they increased the water price 500 times in a month. In a span of a month. I mean, that triggered people to come on the road to demonstrate, and there was a sort of a social conflict. So these decisions can't be taken just by government alone. There needs to be a discussion of what is the capacity of people to pay price, how much are they willing to, and these discussions have not been held clearly and in a transparent manner in many countries, including in developed countries.
The delegation of public services has been justified through arguments such as the superior performance of the private sector and the failure of the public sector to provide adequate services due to a combination of inefficiency, corruption, and weak accountability. However, the same communities that struggle to access this essential resource are also vulnerable to privatization schemes that increase the price and leave the poor unable to afford basic water services.
In recent book chapters in the policy brief with Nitti, we're looking at how it can provide a standpoint shift. With the popular view, it's a zero-sum game, and their water is to be controlled. And I'm speaking in terms of like what is the status quo. In terms of water governance and management, while the status quo is free market control. And the benefits of the free market are that it's efficient in knowledge translation, meaning individuals or communities, the population by and large, doesn't need to know where they get their water, how it's treated. There's just a trust that they'll get water through their taps. As long as you participate in the market without cheating, as long as you pay your bills, you're going to be provided with the material resource. Where I see an issue with that, the free market in general, in terms of water commodification especially, is that there's an epistemic gap. There's a knowledge gap in that people don't understand where they get their water, how they're connected to it. They don't value water in a way that is non-monetary. And that gap provides opportunity for actors in favor of commodification, private corporations, unrepresentative government officials or politics in general, to ensconce themselves, to take advantage of this ignorance and to further privatization and commodification gains.
Water privatization is when private corporations buy or operate public water utilities. A parallel threat is commodification, which is the attempt to turn water into a product from which owners can reap maximum profits at public expense.
Mr. President of the General Assembly, Excellencies, I'm here to sound the alarm. The world must wake up. We are on the edge of an abyss and moving in the wrong direction. Our world has never been more threatened or more divided. We face the greatest cascade of crises in our lifetimes. The climate crisis is pummeling the planet. Upheaval from Afghanistan to Ethiopia to Yemen and beyond has thwarted peace.
According to some human rights organizations, the commodification of water and sanitation sector creates a disconnect between the interests of the company owners and the goal of realizing human rights to water and sanitation.
When I'm in conversation with people, a frequent question that I'm asked is there hope? Like, do you have hope for the future as far as tackling these water-related issues and the climate crisis? And I do believe that the situation is serious, and at face value, it looks quite dire. But when you get below the surface, I do see a lot of hope. I do interact with people in the Guelph, Wellington area where I went to university, especially, that people in that area of Canada are very attuned with water issues in their community. And the antidote to hopelessness is being active, of talking with other people, getting out into the world, getting away from, you know, the four walls that are around you, because if you're just left to your own devices, it can seem quite hopeless. But speaking with other people, getting out there into your community is quite a powerful practice. And that's what I take to be a way to overcome hopelessness. And in another sense, there's no other way that we can reasonably look at these issues. We can't give into a fatalistic mindset. We see people who have struggled and fought and worked against actors who are largely responsible for climate change and water crises for decades upon decades. Now is not certainly the time to give up on any of this. And I look at community activism in the Guelph area. I look at community activism of mobilizing for water access in Detroit. I look at grassroots, bottom-up, youth-led organizations in Canada, and I see plenty of transformative potential, especially amongst young people. I mean, that's where so much of the impetus for these movements is being fomented, with young people. And I find that exciting. And that's where we need to look for further hope, how we're going to tackle these issues going forward.
The availability of resources, hydropower and energy crops, governance quality, sea level rise, droughts and floods all affect people's movement and future movement. The sale of water for profit makes water a commodity for the few, and it denies other people who don't have the ability to pay for it. Migration is a result of pull and push factors. When countries face existential threats or are economically less developed, their capacity for adapting to increasing intensity of water-related events is generally low. Declining livelihood prospects or lower food security cause people to temporarily or permanently to migrate to areas where living conditions are expected to be better. In those cases, the most essential survival strategy for humankind is migration. For an individual, it trickles down to two things. If I migrate, will I be better off in the long run? And do I have the means to migrate?
All this talk about migration begs the question, how far could we go to get water? In the following episode of the Water Series, we're going to space. Join us next time.
Do you want to hear more podcasts that get to the bottom of things that stand out in the ambient noise? Join Europod. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and our newsletter. Follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram. Discover our brand new website at www.europod.eu and join us in our fight. Europod. Clear the noise. Start to listen.